Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Social anxiety affects approximately 15 million adults and about 7% of the population. More than two-thirds of them experience symptoms that first appear in childhood. Social anxiety can lead to avoidance of social situations, extreme fear of judgment, and difficulty in personal and professional interactions. If untreated, it may increase the risk of major depression and substance abuse. Natasha Daniels, a therapist who suffered from social anxiety throughout her life, shares her personal experiences in her book, Out of My Shell. She explores how social anxiety influenced her life and her healing journey through self-acceptance. So, Natasha Daniels, welcome to 411 Teen. So glad to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What is social anxiety? What does it look like? And when I ask, what does it look like, if you would distinguish for us what it looks like in childhood and then what it looks like in adulthood.
Social anxiety is really about the fear of rejection, mm-hmm. criticism, the fear of not feeling like enough, the fear of being embarrassed or scrutinized with other people. A lot of times people think that it's more about being shy or introverted. And so mm-hmm. I want to make that distinction. And it does look a bit different in childhood than adulthood. It's just like the junior and senior version of it, because the fear underneath is exactly the same, that fear of rejection and judgment. In childhood, which is a very self-conscious period of time anyway for most people, especially in those preteen and teen years, it looks like that fear of embarrassment kind of on steroids. You know, the volume is really high. Mm-hmm. And so you might perceive that people don't like you, that you're not fitting in. You might worry that if you're not part of the conversation, that you are the conversation. There's a heightened fear that everybody's staring at you. I feel like developmentally, you feel that way anyway, but it's the acuity of it that makes the difference. And sometimes in childhood, you might start developing some phobic behavior. For me, it was like the fear of reading in public. Some people worry they're going to blush, or they worry that they're sweating, or they worry their smell. So sometimes there's an underlying thing that you kind of get stuck on.
Mm-hmm.
And then in adulthood, it looks similar. And unfortunately, it just carries itself right into your adult life. And so it could show up in your workplace. You could be anxious in party settings, or for me, even just walking down and getting my mail, I felt like everybody's looking at me, everybody's watching me. And so that's just kind of a little summary of what it can feel like.
Okay. I know you wrote that you described it, you write, social anxiety, the hidden tapeworm that is nourished by self-hate and self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think now that you explained it, that says it all.
Yeah, it's this internal mm-hmm. dialogue that is really hard to separate from yourself. And that's why I say it's a hidden tapeworm, mm-hmm. because you don't know it's there. Well, a lot of people don't. Some people do. And so you believe the lies that you're being fed. You believe the narrative that is forming in your head. And so it's really hard to separate out yourself from mm-hmm. what is a disordered thought.
Well, can you tell us about your own experience with social anxiety? When you first really recognized it in yourself, or that something was going on?
Well, I knew something was going on starting in eighth grade. I didn't realize it was social anxiety, and there's irony in this, until I was in my 40s. But that's a separate conversation. But in eighth grade, I really felt like I didn't belong, you know, very much like a lot of people mm-hmm. at that age. I was put in an inner city school, and I didn't fit in with the rougher kids, and I didn't fit in with the small group of kids that were zoned for that area that didn't live in that area. And, you know, I was bullied. And so there was like an environmental stressor, but then social anxiety kind of got its genetic grip on me. And I had an eighth grade teacher who would make everybody read. And for some reason, I just got fixated on that. Like, if I read, I'm going to run out of breath. I'm going to mispronounce a word. People are going to think I'm stupid. And so a lot of people feel that, you know, feel uncomfortable reading in public or feel awkward in middle school.
Mm-hmm.
But just to separate out the severity of it, like, I would ruminate and think about that 1 hour all day long until it came. Then I would have an anxiety attack after I read, during the time I was reading. And then I would be consumed with the thought of having to go back to school and have it like rinse and repeat every day. And that, you know, that's just kind of the flavor of how social anxiety can show up.
Well, you mentioned, you just mentioned how it had a strong genetic component. As you look back, can you think of family members that you would say had social anxiety?
You know, the hard thing with genetics, and I wish that we were a little bit further along with the research on the genetic component of mental health issues,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of times the offspring of parents who have bipolar tend to have anxiety disorders. And so my dad had bipolar, eventually bipolar with psychosis. But all of my offspring, we all have some rendition of anxiety, which I think is, or OCD, which I think is interesting. So it's definitely there in the family tree.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think how it shows up for each person individually is dependent on environmental stressors and maybe even just how it's going to manifest in that particular person.
How did your social anxiety affect your work as a therapist, a child therapist with social for kids with social anxiety disorder?
Yeah, ironically, I thrived in the therapy office. I loved it. You know, and I connected with kids, and I was like, I was so in their head because I totally got why they viewed it that way. And for them, I could see why their thoughts were distorted. You know, I had that clarity that I didn't have within myself about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't realize at the time that it was such a superpower that, you know, teens who would never talk to therapists, and I was maybe the third or fourth therapist the parent had kind of dragged their kids to. And I would click with most of them because they're mm-hmm. like, oh my gosh, she gets it. Because I wasn't just saying, go make friends or like, you know, let's work on your social skills. You know, I understood the thoughts that were fueling that fire.
Well, I like the format of your book. What was it? Then and Now? And mm-hmm. that gave a real comparison, I thought, or a real picture of what social anxiety looked like at 6 years of age or 10 years of age or, you know, 12. Or, and I thought that was, I like that little aspect of it. So that.
Yeah. I think bouncing back and forth gives you that perspective of being so in your story that you have no insight or clarity, and then being, well, it did two things. I was doing therapy sessions with my younger self. So it kind of pulls you out of, it was like, this is how it was viewed at the time. And then mm-hmm. this is how
it is
my adult is perceiving it. But then it also kind of gave you the juxtaposition of, this is me at this young age, and this is how it's showing up in my adult life, and how it looks a little bit different.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why I asked at the beginning if you would make that comparison between childhood and adulthood. I mm-hmm. thought that was real telling. In your book, Out of My Shell, you focus on healing. You talk about healing through self-acceptance. How did this process unfold for you?
It happened accidentally. I really had just come to the point where I was like, you know what? People don't like me. I reject people. For some reason, I just, people don't gravitate towards me. And I guess I'm going to live a life of like having no connections other than my family, which is a sad, you know, it's a sad place to be. But then I wrote my first book. And then, you know, after that, the publisher wanted me to do a platform. And so I was like, okay, I'll create a website. I'll, you know, so I started doing a parent blogging thing. And then I created a podcast.
You and it really was got into it. I remember.
I did.
Yes, you did.
I was like, well, I'm like, I'm all in. Like when I'm going to do a project, you know, you do it into a platform, I'm going to research and I'm going to do it really well. And it threw me into the light, you know, where people can get mean behind a keyboard. People can be nasty in their comments. And I was more in the public and it really brought a light into my social anxiety and having to work on that. And at the same time, it also empowered me where I was like, it felt good to have a voice and it felt good to tell my stories and it felt good to help other people on a global scale. And so I felt like it made me vulnerable and it also empowered me at the same time. And it was a sink or swim situation. It was like, you're either going to keep doing this and you're going to start to have to love yourself and handle rejection, or you're going to have to shut this down because you can't handle it.
What advice would you give to others who may be on the same or similar journey?
I honestly think the first step is recognizing that it's not you, it's social anxiety. And that's a hard thing, maybe even harder than most disorders, mental health disorders, because part of the disorder is really believing that you are a social reject. I wanted my book to be called Social Reject, and the publisher didn't think that was very positive. So that's I love the title, but I just felt like that's how I felt. And so, and as I, you know, I created an Instagram account just for social anxiety for adults when I wrote this memoir, because I normally work with the kids and the parents. And so I'm starting to interact now with all these adults with social anxiety, and the message I'm getting through all of them is, I thought this was just me. I didn't realize this was social anxiety, or I thought I was alone, and just that normalization. So I would encourage people to connect with social anxiety resources or accounts, learn what it looks like, because it's a very isolating disorder more than any other, because you don't even realize often that you have a disorder, and that's the struggle.
Well, I asked you to hold your thoughts right here. It's time for us to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this hour we are talking about social anxiety disorder with Natasha Daniels. We'll return shortly. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. This hour, we're exploring social anxiety disorder with therapist and author and mother, Natasha Daniels, her recent book, Out of My Shell. Natasha, would you share some of the triggers for social anxieties?
I think this is what complicates this disorder, is that the triggers are different for each person. And so you can have someone with social anxiety who is totally comfortable on stage doing a dance recital if everyone else is doing the dance recital with them. And other people, that would be a nightmare. And so tuning into what environments and what stressors trigger your social anxiety is something you want to look at. And I'll give you some examples. Like for me, a non-structured social gathering is like a 10, and it's still a 10 like that. And if I'm by myself, it's a 20, even though I'm on a 1-10 scale. So like learning how to, you know, get into like a crowded room and start to socialize. But for me, if you put me, you know, on a Zoom call with 500 people presenting, I'm fine. I'm in my role. You know, I have a professional role, not a problem. And that might be reversed for some people. Some people might be fine socially in a non-structured environment, and they might panic in a work environment where they feel like they're not enough or they're going to be found out. And so it is really unique to each person. But normally one of the components is worrying you're going to be exposed on some level, or embarrassed on some level, or found out on some level, that you're not enough or that you can't handle it, or something embarrassing is going to happen. That tends to be a common theme throughout.
Let me ask you this. Does it get better?
It does.
Okay.
It does. I feel like part of my journey has been to accept that social anxiety is part of who I am. And so there is an acceptance to, I'm going to have some initial thoughts, you know, and it's a daily practice. And so I don't see it as you're cured from social anxiety. And some people didn't like that when I said that on Instagram. You know, I got a little pushback on that. And I can only speak for myself, but I have been in practice for 20 years. So I saw it also right. with people I work with, even though they were kids. But that's not a negative thing. It just means that just like anything else, you have to keep sharp those skills. It's a muscle you have to practice. And so avoidance feeds social anxiety. I could easily go back and lose some of my progress if I were to continue to avoid things that made me uncomfortable. And so it is a daily practice. I do have those initial paranoid thoughts still that say, I think they're looking at you. But now there's this other voice in my head that goes, all right, well, so what?
Yeah. You know,
or like I wanted to go to the doctor the other day and I felt like I've been going too much. And I thought, oh my gosh, they're going to think I'm a hypochondriac. And then I was like, all right, if they think I'm a hypochondriac, like, are they my friends? You know, like, are they going to like go on a podcast and promote that? Like, why does that matter?
Yeah.
And I think that that's the part that we don't often do with social anxiety is question the thoughts that we're being spoon-fed by our social anxiety.
Mm-hmm. When you think about coping strategies, have you found particular types of things to be effective in managing social anxieties? I mean, what type of cope? And I guess that may vary too when you think about it, depending on the individual.
Yeah, I do think everyone has their favorite coping skills to go to. I think one, though, that is universal is with social anxiety, we're so much in our head. And that is part of the problem is that there's this annoying narration going on as you're, and I think a lot of people have that, but with social anxiety, the volume is just so loud of what's going on in this interaction. Oh, she's asked you questions 3 times and you haven't thrown it back to her. This is selfish. This is all about, you know, you're not asking her stuff. She's never going to want to go out with you again. So this is the kind of narrative, you know, that you can be experiencing. And then objectively, you're not looking engaged or you're looking a little distracted or maybe you're looking anxious and maybe that's being misread by the person and they're thinking, she's not really into this conversation or she's not really connecting with me. I'm not going to call her back. And then that fuels the fire again of, I guess I was right. She wasn't interested in me. And right. it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I would say the first skill to do is to notice when you're in your head. And we're in our head privately as well. But I think the damage is when we're in those social interactions. And so practicing being in the moment, a lot of times, like I'll fixate, I'll purposely notice my brain is going somewhere that's not positive. It's not going to help me. And I'll focus on, oh, I like their sweater or, oh, like really listening to what they're saying. Oh my gosh, that must've been really hard for them. So I'm getting out of my head. I'm becoming a better listener or I'm observing something. So I might even say, oh, I like your nails or ask them a question about their story because I'm really trying to hyper-focus. And that does 2 things. It gets me out of my head. So I'm actually in the moment, enjoying the moment maybe a little bit more. And I'm more engaged. And so it's going to be well-received as well.
Well, for parents who suspect maybe a social anxiety, if they have the right idea that it's not just somebody who's an introvert, okay, but for parents who really have a grasp of social anxiety, what signs should they look for?
Yeah, if your child only has or your teen only has like 1 or 2 friends and they're content with that, or they don't want to go to parties or they're not getting invitations and they're content with that, that's okay. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of us are introverts, and I am an introvert as well. And so in the book, I try to separate out maybe ad nauseum, you know, like what is an introvert versus what is social anxiety? But if your child is, you know, maybe vocalizing that they feel like they're not enough in some way, I look so ugly in that picture, or I'm so stupid, or I'm not as smart as everyone else. A lot of not enoughness. And again, that is individual, because the lack of not enough is different for each person. It could be how they look. It could be about their intelligence. It could be about their humor or how cool they are. It could be athleticism or some extracurricular skill. So it's not across the board, but it's in particular areas. And then, is there some level of social anxiety paranoia? I think they were talking about me at lunch today. Oh, what makes you think that? And it's all the subjective, assuming that is just based on pretty much nothing. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for that kind of theme of feeling like they don't fit in. People are talking about them. People are rejecting them. People are looking at them. And then you'll see some behavioral symptoms as well. I mean, it is genetic. So all three of my kids have different flavors of social anxiety. And the three of us together, four of us together are quite the scene. It shows up in different ways. So somebody's always struggling, which is unfortunate. But like with my son, I can tell when he is really struggling, which is a big amount of the time. And he's 15. When we're in a crowd and all of a sudden I could tell, I'm trying to dance to the music and he's like, stop it, mom, just stop moving, and getting inward and wanting to wear a hoodie and wanting to hide. So if you see those things in your kids, like those are some indications they might be struggling.
Next, what should they look for? Well, if they can find a therapist. I mean, it's pretty difficult to find a therapist whose expertise is social anxiety disorder. I mean, would you agree with that, or is that just...
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to find a therapist. You're not going to find an adolescent therapist that only specializes in social anxiety. I mean, if you do, that is like the unicorn that everybody needs to find, because very rarely do therapists specialize in only one type of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like you can get a therapist that will specialize in OCD, or in particular, like maybe disorders, but not social anxiety. But you want to look for, in my opinion, a cognitive behavioral therapist.
Okay.
Someone who specializes in anxiety, because at least they understand anxiety and how that works. And so that kind of narrows it down, because it is hard. It is hard to find a good therapist that is going to work on. The reason why I say CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is because with social anxiety, you want to tackle the thoughts, the cognitive part. That's really important, because if I'm fueling my anxiety with all these thoughts of they hate me, look, she didn't text me, oh, they talked about a party that I didn't go to. If I don't learn how to manage those thoughts, maybe reframe those thoughts or process them, it doesn't matter what kind of behaviors I'm going to do, because the fuel line hasn't been cut. And the B, the behavioral part of CBT, is now I need to go out and practice this. I need to put myself in situations where I have to handle discomfort. And for me, it's not to prove that people do love me, because that's really feeding the narrative, but that no matter what they do, whether they reject me or not, I can handle that. And that I'm enough just the way I am, regardless of what other people say about me.
So what can parents do to support their children through this treatment? I mean, because I would think that they could apply, even though they may not be trained, some form of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes, okay? I do feel like it's not rocket science. And there are some things that we can do to make things somewhat better and some things that we can do to make it far worse.
Okay.
And I do feel like the things that we don't want to do, we'll start with that, because those are the things that my mom did. And the things that I've worked on when I worked with parents in my practice to coach the parents not to do this, to just say, go make more friends, or go be social, or branch out and do this stuff, or force them without any kind of skill building to do hard things, drop them off and then just watch them sink. And so I know when my mom would say, just go make more friends, or when I was being nasty and hormonal, she'd say, no wonder why you don't have friends. For that, like that's hardwired. That's validation. Let me put that in the file of proof. So we don't want to do things like that.
I was thinking that all along. Now somebody else has said.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Like, she's confirming it. Okay, we're done here. But what we can do, the first thing I think as a parent is to know that we're just one small component of this journey. And so we don't have we don't have the steering wheel. And so I think sometimes we have to have more compassion as a parent for ourselves to recognize that we only have so much that we can do. Because I think sometimes as parents, we want to fix it for our kids.
Exactly.
And if you feel like your child's struggling, I mean, I have three kids with social anxiety. Is that a parent failure? Mm-hmm. I like to think no. I mean, I'm very skilled and I know what it is, both professionally and personally, but it's genetic and it's their journey and I can't grab the wheel. But what I can do is educate them on social anxiety, validate how they feel. So I normalize it. And there's certain, you know, you can connect them with other groups or social skill groups or social anxiety groups. It's not really a social skill problem, but there are groups that facilitate social interaction so that they can have that exposure, but also like letting them know, I know this is really hard. And so it's pushing them out there, but not throwing them off the cliff. With my two youngest, who are now 13 and 15, we have a code word when they're really uncomfortable socially. I guess I'm embarrassing, you know, for their social anxiety. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having a code word for when they're really, really panicky in public, that can be really helpful. And then offering them some exposure opportunities, not always rescuing them. And so sometimes ordering can be hard for people with social anxiety, going to the bathroom. And so kind of identifying with your child, what areas are the scariest for your social anxiety? And then slowly doing some exposures around that. Mm-hmm. But then also, I think finding out where are their strengths? Where is their core identity? And trying to build up over time who they are that no one can take away from them. So finding where are their superpowers? Where do they excel? And it doesn't have to be an outward excelling. It could be like you're incredibly empathetic and kind-hearted, or you're the dog whisperer, you know, or, you know, really fostering that self-identity that will kind of counteract the social anxiety.
Well, it really sounds like it's very difficult to deal with, because you're talking about an anxiety that someone is going to have for the rest of their lives. First of all, they have to buy into it, because I would think that not buying into it might be a big part of it. Well, that's not, no, I don't have that, you know, that's not me. You're misinterpreting. So they've got to buy into it. And then after buying into it, you know, it's that little voice is always in your head, or that little person is always on your shoulder. So you have to be able to recognize, you know, that you need to throw them away, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, is it as hard as I am depicting?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have nothing to say. Yeah, I do think it is hard, and I think that is why.
I mean, you know, it is, because some disorders, I mean, yes, you do have to buy, you have to work on, but this one is particularly resistive.
Yes.
Because what you have to do to make it to move.
Yeah, it's all encompassing, because it's like it's attached itself to your identity. And so it is so all encompassing. And when even you do the things that are difficult to do and you're not avoiding, the second part is the stories that you're still telling yourself. And so you could be doing hard things the rest of your life, you know, the B part of CBT, and never make progress because you're still feeding yourself really horrible stories about how it went and your expectations.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Do you recommend that parents, families have some therapy themselves?
I do think it can be really helpful to learn how to support your loved ones with social anxiety, because it
if
does
not
involve,
you can feed into it and make it worse, I would think.
Oh yeah.
See, that's
it. And you can feed in either direction. You can be overcompensating for your loved one, where you speak for them or you do things for them. You know, my son would want me to order for him. If I did that all the time, I would not be doing him
a favor.
Be doing him a disservice.
Right.
Yeah. And so learning when to pull back. But then you also have people who maybe don't get it, and they're just like, just go order for yourself, or just go to that party, or get out of the car. That was my mom.
And that doesn't work either.
That's not helpful either. So it's finding that sweet spot. And we'll all move a little far to the left or to the right as we parent. It's a daily practice for us as well as parents, but getting that support. And so even if your child has a therapist doing parent sessions and meeting alone with them, if they're willing, if the therapist is willing, can be really, really helpful.
What about the school? How do you address it in the school? Do you find that you get support from the teachers? And I don't know if the school has, nowadays, lots of times schools don't have psychologists. The psychologist may be responsible for 6 schools. I don't know.
Right.
But what role does the school play? I'll put it that way.
The school can play a huge role, because what we see in adolescents with social anxiety is a huge amount of school refusal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a slippery slope. Sometimes they'll start to get nauseous before they go to school, or they're so overwhelmed or they're panicky and they can't go to school. So they wind up being homeschooled, which then becomes more avoidant because now they're more isolated. And then now just going out to a restaurant or going out, it becomes even more isolated. So it's a slippery slope, kind of into agoraphobia, where you don't want to leave your house. And so partnering with your school when you're starting to see, especially school refusal, is really important as a parent to catch it kind of early. You can get a formalized plan. You can get, if you're in the United States, you can get a 504 plan,
mm-hmm.
where you formalize accommodations. And sometimes that is necessary, even though we don't want to accommodate and foster avoidance. I always look at it like an onion, you know, like I just want to get them to school. Like that's the first layer. And then we'll peel it back over time.
Hold your thoughts, and we'll come back and deal with that onion. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Tuned in to 411 Teen. I am talking with Natasha Daniels, therapist, author, and mother. Her recent book, Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety Disorder from Childhood to Adulthood. Natasha, I had to interrupt you. We were talking about peeling that onion. And if you,
yeah.
And if you would like to continue, that'd be great.
Yeah. So, you know, if our child is not able to go to school, or they're getting stomach aches, or we're really seeing mm-hmm. it manifest, that can go sideways really fast. And so reaching out to the school, even if they don't have a psychologist, there's every public school at least does have, I think legally they have to have a way to get a 504 plan or a psychologist that does have like 6 schools.
Mm-hmm.
And there are accommodations that you can make. When I was in my private practice, we had accommodations for kids with social anxiety that included things like they can't be called on without raising their hand, so that there's not this anticipatory anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
We've had kids where they don't have to present in front of the class. They could either make a video or they could present privately to the teacher. We've had preferential seating so that kids, you know, maybe feel trapped or they get distracted by seeing the other kids in front of them. So they have to sit in the front so they're not getting consumed with their, you know, their thoughts around peers interacting. There's been mm-hmm. accommodations around groups, as far as do they have to do group work or can they pick the person that they're doing? And these are temporary accommodations to prevent them from having that school refusal, that school anxiety, and that slippery slope of them not wanting to go to school at all.
Okay. You touched on this, but I was so glad to hear you say it. Homeschooling with a social anxiety disorder is not the answer. And I think that often in homeschooling, you may find that component of parents who have selected homeschool because their child is having a problem and they have selected the wrong way to address it.
It is a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need to, because there are people who have the acuity of their social anxiety is just so extreme that they've already been doing school refusal. And then a lot of times the school district starts to say, we're going to report you to the truancy police, you know, and so it gets hard for parents. I totally understand that. But if you go that route, just know that's not the end solution. It will more often than not exacerbate the problem, because it's not the school that was the issue, unless they were having some objective bullying. And that's a different story. Sometimes the environment, just because they have social anxiety doesn't mean there's not something objectively going on in an environment. You want to rule that out. But if you are going to do homeschooling or online schooling, then you're going to want to have them connected to some sort of social outlet outside of the home environment. And you're going to have to be really careful about getting them outside of that house, connecting them to co-ops, or sometimes they do hybrid programs where maybe it's 2 days in a school environment, or you can even sign them up for some sort of peer or teen club or support outside as a requirement for them to continue to practice that social interaction.
I'm going to ask you now, because I can tell from the conversation that I will forget. Will you share where we can get your book, how one who's listening may want to keep contact with what you're doing? I mean, do you have a blog, website? Share your contact information with the listening audience.
I do. Normally, I'm doing work with anxiety and OCD for parents. Like, that's my main thing. And so I created something just for this, since I don't normally, this is not normally my main platform. So you can go to socialanxietyreality.com, and that will tell you where you to find me and my book. And I did create an Instagram account called Social Anxiety Reality, where I'm doing kind of confessional reels every other day about my social anxiety.
Okay. All right. What would you identify as the hardest part of social anxiety?
You know, I feel like the self-hate and the self, almost like humiliation. I think that, like, having your worst enemy in your head is definitely the worst part. It's just having this critic. And we all have that critic, but with social anxiety, I keep saying, like, the volume is turned up, and just having this nagging person being like, that was stupid. Why'd you say that? Oh, you weren't. And it doesn't end when you're not in a social situation. It goes all the way into before you go to bed, while you're sleeping, even you dream about it. And so that is definitely the worst part. It's like, how do you shut that thing off?
Public speaking is, you know, often a major trigger to those with social anxiety. How did you approach sharing your personal story publicly in Out of My Shell? What made you want to write such a revealing memoir about your struggles?
I didn't set out to do that. I, on my podcast, I had someone come on who wrote a memoir about panic disorder. And so I read her book for the interview, and I was like, oh, I love mental health memoirs. And so it became kind of a thing for me, where I wanted to devour mental health memoirs because I love people's stories, and the fact that it's real was, like, powerful to me. And so I was like, I need one on social anxiety. And I searched, and I couldn't find one that was just solely on social anxiety. It'd be something like depression, but then they struggle with social anxiety. And I'm like, no, that's not what I want. And so eventually I was like, there's nothing out there that I could find, at least. And so I decided I was going to write one myself. And I got really into just the art of memoir. I was like, oh, this is, writing is fun. And then I actually met with a professor who taught how to write memoir. And she said, when you're writing your memoir, don't think that anyone else is going to read it. And so I really bought into that, to the point where when I finally realized, like, the publisher is going to, like, put it out in the world, because it was like 5 years later, I had a panic week. I was like, oh my gosh, people are going to read this. Like, people started to give me feedback. There were, like, early advanced readers, and I had to give it to some people that I knew to, like, to read it. And I started to have some anxiety attacks, because I thought, like, it did feel really naked. And I forgot that this was not a personal project.
Oh, well, if it goes untreated, we haven't talked about that aspect of it, so I think we need to. If it goes untreated, the social anxiety, what happens when you have an untreated social anxiety shape someone's life into adulthood? I mean,
it's
what
very,
can we anticipate?
You know, it'll be different for each person, mm-hmm. but a lot of times it's a very isolating life. You know, not taking any risks because that fear of rejection is so palatable. And so on the very extreme, you have people who really won't leave their house. To leave their mm-hmm. house is to be very overwhelmed. So that's really on the extreme end of things. Moving from the less extreme, I think you have people that get stuck in dead-end jobs because they don't want change. They don't want rejection. They don't make new friendships. They don't have a good support system. There's maybe some secondary depression or even self-medicating that goes mm-hmm. with social anxiety. And so addiction can be a common thing as well. I can't go and hang out with these people unless I take a substance or I drink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it can really create a dysfunctional way of being in the world.
Do you have steps that you recognize or you encourage adults to take when addressing this untreated social anxiety? Do you have particular steps or suggestions? If it hasn't been treated, boy, you've got a lot to deal with.
Yes.
Yes. And it's going to spill over into every aspect of your life. I mean, professional, personal, relaxation. I mean, all of it. And so you're going to be a real tortured individual, really.
And you may not be aware of it.
Right.
I mean,
yes.
I was not aware of the level of intensity my social anxiety was kind of controlling me until it got lifted. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the mm-hmm. first thing I realized when I was walking to my mailbox one time and I was like, oh, I'm not 100%, because I still am a little bit. I'm not 100% worried that everyone's staring at me as I'm walking to the mailbox. Or I went to like my kid's band concert, and like for the first time ever, I wasn't like so self-conscious and like pulling out my phone to just look like I was busy as I sat there by myself. I was like bored. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm actually just bored. Normally I'm looking around, I'm thinking, oh, those moms are friends and those moms are friends and I have no friends. And yeah, mm-hmm. so it can be through everything. And I think the first step, and you know, I'm not very formulaic in my approaches, but I think that there is a linear process to working on your social anxiety. And the first step is to, you know, spend 24, 48 hours jotting down the upsetting thoughts that you're having or that negative narration that's going on in your head. What are the things that you're hearing? Because you may be so used to it that you're not separating it out. And so that awareness is the first step. And then I would say, rate from 1 to 10 the things that give you heart palpitations. Like if you can think of like a reverse bucket list, that's how I thought about it when I was doing mm-hmm. mine. Like what's a reverse bucket list? The worst things I would rather die.
That's what I thought you were going to say. So.
Yeah. And then, you know, they were up there. But there was a theme that started to present itself for me, which people who are listening, they might start seeing a theme for themselves. For me, it was non-structured social situations. Mm. So small talk, you know, conferences where there's a break in between or where we have to socialize or, you know, worse yet, like a mixer or something, that would mm-hmm. be a nightmare. And so, and it might be something really simple for people. It might be just ordering out or it might be walking down a street, but look at those patterns and then ask yourself, what is the commonality between those? What scares you the most? For me, just to use an example, like my core fear was people will find out that I'm a loser. Mm-hmm. People will see that, oh, that girl has no one to talk to. That girl's alone. And they would put some judgment on me. And there's a lot of different core fears that people can have, but tune into that because then you want to reframe that. And so does it matter what they think? Could I just be sitting alone because I'm an introvert? Mm-hmm. And can I accept that they might misunderstand me or they might judge me and I can still be okay? And then the last part is then you got to put yourself in situations where you actually deal with that. And that's the hardest part. And so then you put yourself in that restaurant or you walk down that street or you purposely make small talk with a cashier or you do something like that, that gets you practicing. Not, and like I said, but I think I mentioned this before, not to say, oh, wow, people really do like me or that really did go well, because it doesn't always happen that way. It's to show you that you can do it no matter what. And that you can handle the discomfort that comes with it and you can get to the other side.
See, I'm stuck on the awareness and how you get or how one gets their client or whatever past, you know, awareness. Because of the dynamics of the disorder, people think, well, that's just the way I am. That's the way it is. I mean, and they don't have an appreciation or a feel for this is not normal. This is out of the realm, you know. And how, I, you know, I mean, you may not have an answer for that. I don't really know. But I'm just thinking awareness is so very important, but so hard, so very difficult to grasp, to deal with. I don't know.
And to acknowledge it is almost to feel like you have to own it and do something about it. And so it's much easier. And I know I was in this spot before as well, where it's much easier to just say, it's not a social anxiety disorder that I have to work on. People just don't like me, or I don't like people. You see that as well. The reverse of like, I don't like people and I like my life and I just want to be in my apartment. I don't want to deal with people. That's a defense mechanism. I mean, you might be an introvert, but, and I think sometimes getting the insight is switching the question around and saying, what are things that you wish you could do? What are things that are hard for you to do, but that are important for you to do? And for me, it's important for me to go, this is in the past, to kids' birthday parties. I'm so, so glad that that's not really an issue anymore. Like, I can drop you off. I don't have to go. But, you know, I needed to go to these birthday parties. I didn't want to hold my kids back socially by not interacting with the parents. I did want to go to the band performances, but that was like a 10 for me. I did want to go to these conferences and I wanted to network because that's important. And I was out of the loop, but my social anxiety wasn't letting me do it. So maybe asking a different question of getting into their values and like, what things are you not able to do that you wish you could do? And then there's a little bit of a pull, like a little bit of a string that you can pull from there.
In these last couple of minutes, first of all, do you have any additional resources you may offer to the listening audience? Any apps, any blogs, any books, in addition to yours, okay, that you might offer that might be really beneficial and help them improve their insight and, you know, have a grasp, you know, for what is actually going on?
Yeah, I think going to socialphobia.org is a really good start because they list resources, they list places to get help. So going to that particular website, because there's other resources that are just anxiety based. But I think if you really want to get to social anxiety, start there, and then that'll be a good launching pad to other resources.
Well, it's always a delight to talk with you. You bring some real valuable insights to our conversation. Do you have any closing words of wisdom? I always ask my guests. Share your words of wisdom with the listening audience.
Well, I do appreciate you, you know, giving me a platform to talk about social anxiety, because I'm sure there's people listening who are like, didn't think they had social anxiety until after this conversation and are like, wait. Like, I thought that that was me. I thought that I was alone. And so, you know, my biggest message that I hope people are getting from this is that you're not alone, and look into social anxiety disorder, because once you recognize that there is a brick on your back, then you are able to take it off and remove it and feel that light. You may not realize that there's this weight on you, this burden on you that's holding you back until you start to identify it.
Well, I thank you, because it is time out for this edition of 411 Teen. I've been talking with Natasha Daniels, therapist, mother, and author of Out of My Shell, Overcoming Social Anxiety from Childhood to Adulthood. Natasha is always very positive and informative discussion, so I thank you. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your time and ear. Peace to you all. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 team at wfsu.org.